Street View Podcast is part of the Dallas Public Library's Homeless Engagement Initiative, dedicated to increasing community awareness of issues related to homelessness. The opinions expressed are solely those of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Dallas Public Library or the City of Dallas.
How do you want to see it? What do you want to do? You got it all figured out, straight from your cube. Life's a musical, maybe a carousel. How do you want to see it? What do you want to do? Perception starts with selection. The same streets you walk on, they carry their own view. This is Street View.
Most gracious and heavenly Father, we come right now in the name of Jesus Christ with the anointing and the love and the peace that passes all understanding. We actually trying to pass that peace to others, God. We're trying to be conductors of your love and also distributors of life. We thank you for this opportunity and this time, God, as we sit and we join and we fellowship, sharing one to another something that might evoke change or hope or peace or dreams or fun. We pray these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. What's up, Street View listeners? This is Rashad Anthony Dickerson. Y'all kind of know that, but just wanted to speak it. Today on the show, we have several guests. We have, of course, the captain. Can't do it without the captain, the instrument, the guy who's orchestrating the instruments that we use to broadcast to you. Today, we also have Mr. John
Dornheim.
Ooh, that's difficult. John Dornheim today on the show.
If you'd like, I'll change it for you tonight.
Thanks for coming, Mr. Dornheim. He's with NAMI, National Association of Mental Illness. We have the one and only Mr. Malcolm Varner on the show, conductor, the CEO, chief of helping people out over here at the library. We also have an AmeriCorps member, Ms. Janice Brunward. She's going to be on the show with us today talking about some of her experiences with mental illness here at the library. I came because I was once homeless and I also was diagnosed with mental illness. I refute those charges. I am not a crook. I refute those things, but many people who have mental illness do always. And so we want to talk a little bit about the facts and the statistics and also about NAMI, because the only way I found out about NAMI was that I was locked up and I had to actually do a little bit of digging. So we're going to go ahead to Mr. John, Mr. Dornheim. Don't change it.
Yay.
thanks for coming on the show. My question is, first off, thanks for coming. Second off, my question is, give us a little insight, if you can, about mental illness. Some of its stigmas, some of its the stipulations to which people have surrounded us with as far as mental illness is concerned. Please.
Do I have 5 or 6 hours? No. One of the things people don't realize is that 1 in 4 people are affected by mental illness, and that's every year. So that's a huge number. And what corporations are finally realizing is that it affects their workers, not only their workers who have the mental illness, but the workers who are the family members and friends, because they have to take more time off. And even when they're in their jobs, they're less productive than if they weren't dealing with someone with a mental illness. So, you know, that is one of the reasons why, with the healthcare laws and different things, that mental illness is being included as an illness and not a side category.
I'm interested, after talking to Malcolm several times about counseling and things of that nature, I'm really, really interested in understanding more about mental illness. I'm not actually like really hip to it. I mean, you could say somebody has a mental illness, and from what I was actually told is that the only way an individual knows if they have a mental illness is by the observation of an outside party. Is that true?
That's a good way. Another, you can also self-diagnose yourself. I mean, basically, if you're, you know, sad for an extended period of time, if you're afraid of going out of the house, of crowds, you know, I mean, there's different, if you're afraid of public speaking, you know that you have anxiety, so you want to go to the doctor for that. So there's a lot of levels of mental illness, and that's, I think, what scares people is they think that everybody is wild in the streets and that that's what mental illness means. And there are so many levels of mental illness. So many famous people have had bipolar disorder, OCD, schizophrenia, major depression, and they have been some of the great leaders of our world. And but your average next door neighbor, your brother, your sister, your person you marry could have OCD, could have anxiety for being in public spaces, for being in an enclosed elevator. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of people you know who don't want to go on the high five in Dallas because it's scary to them to drive up that high. Now, that's a mental illness because that's an anxiety disorder. So, you know, we don't really have to label everything, but if we did, you know, we'd find out that so many people have that problem, and some people are afraid of dogs. You know, that's an anxiety disorder too.
Right. So tell us a little bit about NAMI then.
Well, NAMI stands for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and NAMI Dallas here was founded in 1982, and what we do as a local and as a national organization is we help people with mental illness and their families with education, with support, and with advocacy. So we have a whole line of classes for people with mental illness and for their family members to take so that they learn more about the illnesses and also so they learn how to contribute to the world with their illness or how to contribute to the care of their loved one who has the illness.
So there's a lot of education out there. How can someone contact you?
Well, they can call the NAMI office at 214-341-7133. All of our services are free, and we get no government funding, no religious funding. We have, you know, that's one of the problems is getting funding for a program like ours that not only deals with education and support, but also deals with advocacy so that we can advocate for people with mental illness. You know, we feel that we have to be very careful on who we endorse or what we endorse. So basically, as an advocate, we look at helping people with mental illness and not at picking people in parties or selecting, say, a state representative or a senator to support. But what we do is we try to educate them and have you support candidates who support people with mental illness and people who have chemical dependency issues.
Now, you all have an advocacy or a legislative event coming up in February. Is that not correct?
That's correct. That's on the 19th, which is next Thursday. And we're very excited. We have a full bus now, and we have a waiting list of other people who want to attend. And it's Capitol Day, and people come from all over the state to Austin. We have buses from Houston and San Antonio and I think the Gulf Coast area and San Marcos. And then, of course, the local Austin people are going to be there. And we all meet and have an informational session. We have lunch together. Then we go to the steps of the Capitol and have a rally. And then we go in and we have preset appointments with our local legislators and senators. And we meet with them or their aides. And we have our points that we want to discuss with them. And one of them is the big points is housing, because, as you know, lack of housing for people with mental illness causes a lot of the homelessness.
My question is, at what point do you decide that someone who is mentally ill could actually stay on their own or be, self-sufficient? On their own, or if I gave somebody who has a mental illness, and like I said, I'm not too versed in mental illness. If I gave somebody who was mentally ill an apartment, how could I ensure that that's being taken care of or that that's the right solution for that person?
Well, you don't really start off with that. That's kind of the end point. The idea behind when the bridge was created here in Dallas and was for people to transition into living by themselves. And so the bridge actually has levels where you earn the next level when you're showing that you're doing something to find a job and doing something to better yourself. And then you get put on lists like with LifeNet and other organizations. And when they find that you haven't been using drugs and that you've been taking your meds and that you're going to group therapy and things like that, then you get to the point where they review you and say, it looks like Joe is ready for his individual apartment. But when they do that, they also don't put you out by yourself. You know, there are people there who check up on you and make sure you're doing okay and that you don't drift back to your old way of life.
I have heard of LifeNet. I've also heard of OPA. Are you guys intertwined with both of those organizations?
Yes, we work with the Homeless Alliance. We work with everybody, basically, who needs help, especially the family members. We try to reunite family members if we can. And one of the big things is education. If they understand the illness and they understand that their family member is not a bad person, that they're a person who is sick and needs help, you wouldn't abandon someone if they had cancer or if they had diabetes. So why abandon them if they have mental illness?
That's true. So what about those individuals who are not assertive in, I guess you could say, rehabilitation, or those individuals who are not headed toward that same, who don't really understand the level system up at the bridge, uh-huh, or who are in encampments who also have mental illness? How does NAMI actually deal with that? Or is there an agenda toward those individuals?
There really isn't, because we don't provide counseling. And so we have to basically wait until people are farther along to really help them. Now, we can still help their families when they're at that point. And we do. We have several families who have a family member with a mental illness who is homeless, who's living on the streets either here or Austin or somewhere. And we work with them to help them maybe reconnect with their loved one and have an understanding of why their loved one is living on the streets and doesn't want to be living with them or under somebody's roof. Some people, they are so ill or so distressed with life that they don't want to be even in an encampment, that they want to live under the stars.
Last question about this. So, in essence, there's no way to get to start from the bottom with the individual, but there is a way to help a loved one, in a sense. That's what you're saying. It's like, if I'm homeless and I have a mental illness and I'm not following the program that's up laid at the bridge or one of the other organizations that are tied up under you guys' umbrella, my best bet is for my family to interact or intervene on my behalf.
Well, that, and there is a CRCG, which is, it's a community group that helps people who are homeless, and it meets monthly to review cases that are at the bridge. And what it, there's actually one for adolescents and there's one for the homeless. And what it does is it brings together community partners who are in chemical dependency, psychiatric hospitals, folks at the bridge, the Dallas Police Department, people like Ron Cowart with the police department who works with the homeless populations. And folks actually come in and present themselves. And they talk about what they want, what their goals are. And we try to ask them the right questions and then at the end try to figure out how to make that happen for them, if it's at all possible. You know, if they have realistic goals, we try to, you know, say, oh, well, if this person will go in this program and they'll get sober and then they can come back to the bridge and do the next level up. And then maybe there'll be housing available in 6 months that if they work the program. So you don't give up on the people. Yes. You just have to realize that the people that are most deserving who are working the program well are the ones that get the housing first. But you don't want to ignore the people who haven't gotten there yet.
Mr. John, how'd you get into this?
Well, actually, I suffer from severe depression, and I didn't get into it because of that, but I worked at a psychiatric hospital, and I was at a meeting of an organization called Celebration Recovery, which was an event being put on in the city of Dallas at Eddie Dean's, and the person who chaired the committee was a board member of NAMI Dallas. And one day she invited me to a meeting, and I went to the meeting. And I enjoyed the meeting and I enjoyed the fellowship and meeting all the different people. And I joined that night. And they approached me and said, do you want to help volunteer? Do you want to do this, do that? And so actually back then there was a charity golf tournament put on by the Dallas Morning News. Mm-hmm. And so I worked that for several years until it disappeared. and, you know, got more involved. And then I got asked to be on the board, and then I became the board vice president and then the board president of NAMI Dallas. And I'm actually the state president of NAMI right now. And so I kind of got, it became my family, my second family. And so I really believe in what NAMI does, and I believe in the programs. I'm a family-to-family teacher, which is our program that works with the parents of adult children with a mental illness. And it's a 12-week course that is 2 hours at a time, basically. And it really integrates the family member or the friend into the treatment and into the knowledge about the mental illnesses. And you also learn when you're being manipulated, because just because you're mentally ill doesn't mean you're not extremely bright. And so a person can learn how to manipulate their family members to get what they want and to get lazy. And there's a difference between not being able to do something and not wanting to do something.
Now, is it possible for you to tell us more about your role as a special projects manager and what NAMI Walks is and what that entails and the importance of NAMI Walks?
Yeah, well, NAMI Walks, this is our 10th anniversary of having that here in Dallas. And it's the 13th anniversary of it being nationwide. It started in 5 sites by NAMI National, and it's expanded to now about 75 sites across the country in major cities or major metropolitan areas. And what the walk is a way for us to fund ourselves during the year. And basically, our NAMI gets about 70% of our funding from the walk. And a lot of states give NAMIs funding. That's it, part of the budget. The state of Texas does not do that, but I was at National Walk Training and some of the people were talking about, oh, we get $300,000 from the state of Wisconsin or whatever state it was, you know, and this is fun money when we do the walk. And I said, this is not fun money for us. This is so that we have some paid staff and that we can still do the free programs. So the walk is May 9th, Saturday. Our honorary chair is Brian Cuban, the younger brother of Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. And Brian is an amazing guy. He has many issues that he's been dealing with and is in recovery from. He has severe depression. He has alcoholism and drug abuse he's dealing with. He has steroid use he's dealing with. And he has body dysmorphia. He grew up with a mother who told him he was a fat kid. And he felt like he was fat. In college, you know, he wouldn't eat. And so he got very thin and, you know, he had a lot of self-respect issues. And luckily, he had a strong family unit. And he actually, at one point, was thinking about taking his own life. And he remembered something his father had said. His father had said something about how, you know, you can get married and you can have friends and everything, but you have two brothers and you and those brothers have to stay close and you have to be there for each other. And so he remembered that. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why he's here today. But he has written a book called Shattered Image, very, very excellent book. And he is working on his second book. And he's touring the country now, speaking at college campuses. And many times he's speaking for free. He's just asking people to fly him there and put him up in a motel. And he goes to assemblies or whatever and speaks to the kids about all his issues and about how long it took him to climb out of all that to be the person he is now.
So based upon what you just said, based upon the things you've just said, do you think that one of NAMI's major roles is to build self-esteem in an individual?
Yeah, I think it's not only building self-esteem in the individual, but also building it in their family member. Because it's hard to understand, unless you're in their shoes, how a family member suffers when their loved one suffers. And so many people who don't get help, either through a support group or through classes, that the family member ends up having mental illness. They get severely depressed because they feel helpless. And so that's part of what we try to do with the classes and with the support groups. We have family support groups and we have support groups for their loved ones.
Is there any simple, or even when I say simple, I mean any remedies that you could give to the listeners to stabilize a situation where an individual is dealing with symptoms of an illness?
Well, number one I'll say is the sooner you get help, the better off your loved one's going to be. So if you think that your teenager or young teen or early 20s family member is acting different than they did, you know, that they're spending more time by themselves, that they're crankier than usual. And teenagers, of course, are normally cranky. So that makes it more difficult sometimes. If they don't hang around the friends that they had, if they've lost interest in schoolwork, things like that, because a huge proportion of mental illnesses strike the late teens and early 20s. And so it's ending high school and it's in college when a lot of the mental illnesses hit. So you have to be vigilant and really watch out for that and get them help immediately. Even if they think that they're okay and they argue or whatever, get them some help and get them evaluated so you can get the meds on them. So that, you know, most people don't realize that the longer it takes you to get the medication and get the therapy, the less good brain cells you're going to have left. So if you wait until you're 55 and get diagnosed and get medication and get therapy, you don't have as much to repair that's left as if you were like 20 and got that help.
You're saying like, so deterioration sets in and your tolerance is also at a lower level than I guess you would start at once you find out earlier on. That's pretty much
what's and also what they found is that you get earlier onset Alzheimer's. And, you know, the average person who has severe mental illness and doesn't get it treated, they live 20 years less than the rest of the population. And a big part of that is because if you don't get your mental illness treated, you don't get your physical illnesses treated.
John, could you tell us a little more about the support groups that you offer? Well, and I have one other question I'm going to put on top of that. At the help desk at the library, do you have any insight in dealing with the people that come in that do have mental illness issues? We're just
yes
a resource.
And yes.
Okay. Yeah.
As far as support groups, we have them all over the area. So we have them north, and we have them in Irving. We have them, you know, south in the Duncanville area. We have them centralized. So if you go to the NAMI website at namidallas.org, you can pull up the support groups. You can also pull up the classes. Our classes usually run the way a school class would run. So they basically run by semester. So there's a spring and fall semester. So the spring semester had started just in the last week or two, just like a school would have. And so it runs 12 weeks. We usually have a class or two in the summer, but it's harder for people to commit to going to a class for 10 or 12 weeks in the summer because of family fun. And then the second part is one of the things that we're offering, which we can't offer for free because we have to pay for it, but it's a non-NAMI class called Mental Health First Aid. And we are basically doing it for cost around, we've done it at the County Commissioner's Office for Commissioner Daniel and her staff and a few people from the other commissioners. We've done it at the Bridge. We've done it for Adult Protective Services workers in North Texas. We trained 93 of them in mental health first aid, and several other groups have taken the class, and it's a full-day class for nonprofits and government. We only charge $25 a person, and that barely covers our costs because we have to order manuals that cost us $20, plus we have to do copying and things, so that takes up the other five. But the mental health first aid class is really good because it goes into situations like you're talking about somebody walks in, and how do you know if they're drunk or they're going to be disorderly? And if they are disorderly, how do you handle that? And if you can tell that they're in a crisis, who do you call? Where do you go? A lot of that is covered by the mental health first aid class. So that's one of the things. Another thing is to contact the crisis team at the City of Dallas Police Department. And also, one of the things that we do at NAMI is we try to have family members have all their information together. So, you know, have it centrally located where you have the listing of the doctor and when they were hospitalized and what medications are on and what volume the medications are on. And also know if they're still on the medication. See, if you're at home and your loved one goes into crisis and you're afraid of them, which happens very often to an elderly parent who has a 45-year-old son who's 6'3", and they're very concerned and they think that they're very erratic and they call 911 and want help, they need to let the dispatcher know that it's a mental illness crisis. And they also need to say, basically, that if they're armed or not and if they're on their meds or not. That's very important for the officers to know, because if the officers know that they're armed and they may not be on their meds, then they will send a larger team because they'll have more safety there. And they're also, one of the things I want to do is get that family member out of the house so they can deal with the family member who's in the crisis.
Now, on your website, you have a 911 checklist, right, as a resource that basically involves if you are making that phone call to the police, you know, to sort of have these items prepared right. for that phone call in order for the policeman to be prepared upon
yeah,
arrival.
Yeah, it makes it much safer for them, you know, especially knowing that there's a weapon or not, because if you surprise an officer and they're expecting just somebody who's like acting out, and then somebody walks out the door and is brandishing something that looks like a dangerous weapon to them, you know, they're going to react differently than if they know there's a weapon involved. They're going to have more people, and they're going to stay back farther, and they're going to know to address the weapon.
When we come back, man, I'll tell y'all a little story about education about mental health, education and mental health, and why it's very, very important. Y'all stay tuned. So I was thinking about the story I had, right? So I was locked up. I'm locked up, Mr. John, and at that time, I'm at a mental health treatment facility. They offer anger management. I think it was required. And so, you know, Being a class clown my whole life, I thought, well, I go in there and clown around. I went in there and I clowned around. Got sent back to the jail. I get back to the jail and I look over the information for myself. And I'm studying it by myself, and it empowers me to do the very thing I'm doing now, which is public speaking. Learning the terms as well as the tools necessary in order to facilitate daily life came from the best. And I saw this and I thought this was the best thing I had ever actually read for myself, because it was so empowering. I took it and I ran with it and I brought it to the library. And I brought it directly. I brought it full circle. I came right to this library and I met Jasmine and we started talking and I started telling her about mental health. At that time, I was in LifeNet classes. I wasn't actually a part of it, but I was allotted to go to the classrooms. And I come to the library and I gave it to the AmeriCorps members and I'm like, yo, man, this is awesome. And everybody kind of went, yeah, yeah. We have millions of books in here. But now I found out that the library is getting ready to do training as far as sensitivity, because the library, as in several libraries in metropolitan areas, deal with a large amount of homeless individuals. I read an article the other day and it was talking about how, you know, you come to the library and somebody's in the bathroom washing their socks in the bathroom, and because they have mental illness. I want to ask you, Mr. Malcolm, about the training you guys are getting ready to do.
As a part of the Homeless Engagement Initiative here at the library, one of the needs that became evident as far as the initial setup and the groundwork of the initiative were the needs that staff had in terms of training and being aware of more resources. And so we completed a staff survey at the end of last year, and we had over 50 staff participate in the survey to get some feedback in terms of some training needs. And so based on that, that survey that we disseminated to staff, we came up with six trainings that we're doing. And so we just kicked it off last month. And our first training was examining causes of homelessness and stigma. But as far as the ones that relate to the topic that we're really dealing with right now, we're going to have one on conflict de-escalation and personal safety tips. That's going to be in March. And then someone from MetroCare Services is going to be providing a training on mental health concerns and situational tips with us on May 27th. And so we have four of the trainings that we're doing, but this is sort of, you know, laying the groundwork for our staff to feel more comfortable and empowered to act upon certain situations. And it sounds like the mental health first aid class that you all do, it, you know, could be a really helpful tool, you know, for us to look at, you know, as well at some time in the future.
Yeah, there are a lot of it's a very interesting class because it not only has a great workbook, but you have the option. And we are the person I work with is a retired sergeant from the Dallas County Sheriff's Department. Okay. And she and I use a lot of scenarios in our 8-hour training. And so we think that you really learn a lot from acting to that, and also to see what you would do. And that's the thing. A lot of people don't realize how they would react to something. It's enough to say, oh, yeah, I'd be fine if somebody did blank, blank to me. Yeah. But when you're in a scenario and somebody does it to you, how do you really react to it? And do you really know how to slow down the escalation of that? And so that's one of our favorite parts. And there's we do a lot of team building, too, because when you work for a library, you work for any, we want to really position this toward banks, too, because we know that people hang around the downtown banks and things like that a lot, and they don't know what to do. The guards don't know what to do. The tellers don't know what to do when somebody who's homeless or who has mental illness comes in there. And so, you know, we really want people to feel more secure and to get people the right help and not just call the police and say, put them in jail, because that's not what somebody with mental illness needs to, that's not where they need to go.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's criminalization of both homeless and mentally ill is really, really sickening. To be honest, man, I deal with it so much so that just the everyday conversation, you could be conversing with somebody that has a mental illness. I was at the store the other night, and we're standing in line at I believe it's like a Dollar General, Dollar Tree or something like that. And an individual, it's clear that she has mental illness because not only is her demeanor not, I guess you would say, upkept, but the way she's speaking. And so it was a simple transaction, a miscommunication. The lady behind the register asked the lady to give her the stuff that she hasn't paid for back. And so, okay, well, the lady who's behind the register doesn't really have customer service skills that are adequate to handle somebody that is in a situation or in an episode of mental illness wherein they're like in a psychosis, I guess you would say. And so, you know, I'm standing waiting just to pay for, I don't know, maybe three or four items, and it's a verbal war going on before me. Because for lack of education or not, I felt as if the lady who's behind the register is jesting with this lady or taking it to a place where, because she doesn't have, she's not properly trained how to, as far as to talk to an individual, she's resorting to something that's probably unhealthy and unproductive.
She's arguing, and we actually work with the police and the fire department. And one of the things we say is, you know, y'all are used to being in charge, but one of the things that escalates quicker than anything else is to argue with somebody. And so, you know, your main thing as you walk in is to say, no, that's not really the way it's going to be. Da, da. But you have to pull yourself back. And that person didn't realize that, you know, that's what they needed to do was pull back. And, you know, I was going to a story and I've forgotten the story, but you go ahead. I'll think of it.
I think both of those sort of pieces are absolutely correct. And that brings to sort of to bear what we're dealing with, you know, here at the library is just understanding, you know, that small tweaks in behavior or body language, even, you know what I mean, can make a huge difference and speaking to someone. And certainly, you know, we've had instances in terms of our own security here, you know, just in terms of approaching people and being direct, super direct and authoritative, you know, with someone. And that creates walls. And so, you know, the idea behind these trainings is that, you know, our staff will be equipped with other ways in terms of addressing, you know, situations so that they're sort of de-escalated from the beginning.
How do I reassure the patrons of the library that this is a safe place and environment after the training we got going on? Like, how can I? Because for a long time, I hadn't understood this, but people have now designated the library to be the new homeless shelters. And it only makes sense to go to a library, which is a public place where you won't be discriminated against. So how do we assure the patrons?
Well, I think the library is already moving in the right direction. And to speak on that, we've done two homeless engagement surveys so far. So Jasmine and the AmeriCorps crew at that point of time, they kicked off the first, you know, survey in 2013. We did a follow-up survey last year. And the individuals who expressed feeling comfortable with staff and feeling welcome here at the library and who've had positive experiences with the staff, we had higher numbers in this last survey than there were in 2013. And so that lets us know that certainly, you know, through the Homeless Engagement Initiative and the programs and activities that the library has been doing over for, you know, the past year and a half now, that we're making inroads with customers. And so that we'll just have to continue to measure those, you know, after the trainings that we're doing and new programming, to see, you know, to get a feel from the people directly in terms of, is what we're doing making an impact?
You know, one of the things to do is to be proactive, so that once your staff has some training, they'll be more comfortable and they'll recognize somebody with mental illness, and they'll be more welcoming and maybe, you know, make the person feel more at home because they realize and they're not kind of taken aback and pull back from that person. And I remember my story about mental health first aid, but I think it's a fun one about, I was coming back from an international flight and I was in DFW and we were in security and there was an older woman and she was way back at the end of the line and I could hear her and she was getting more and more agitated. And I could hear her say she'd lost her companion that she had traveled with, and the other woman was in a wheelchair and someone had taken her and was, you know, wheeling her through somewhere. And they had a connecting flight. And this other woman was so concerned that the woman in the wheelchair was not going to get the connecting flight. So she kept on skipping around the line, getting in front of people and moving through. And you could hear her voice was getting louder and she was getting more incoherent. And so part of the mental health first aid training is to try to help people like that when you realize that they're, you know, going to escalate. And also that the people in security are not going to understand. They're going to think she's a threat and not somebody who's having a difficulty. So when she got close to me, I went up to one of the people in security and I said, this lady is, you know, is having a rough time. She's trying to find her companion. Can you assist her? And so he did. And, you know, instead of having her rant and rave, you know, he knew that she was, is in a difficult situation. He went out of his way to help her. So that's one of the things you want to do. And in the library at work too.
What I'm gaining from this conversation is that sometimes what we would consider as a disruptance could also be a psychotic episode, basically.
That's very true, and I'm glad you brought that. That's been one of the areas where I've engaged staff and had conversations with in order to understand that, for our staff to understand that difference, that there's a difference between somebody who is being intentionally disruptive because they're having an argument with their significant other, or they didn't like the way a staff, you know, provided assistance, and so they're being rude back to them, the staff or whatnot, versus someone who is symptomatic, you know, in some way or another, and they may be having involuntarily spasms or, you know, outbursts. I think staff being aware of that is really key to avoid sort of, you know, larger issues or getting security involved or the police involved, because those issues don't even necessarily warrant, you know, that level of interaction. Because a person actually is just going through something else. And I can think of a handful of, you know, examples where this has happened. And just speaking with him, you know, on a personal level will actually, you know, get them in a better place.
Well, I congratulate you guys for doing the training. And I think the best solution for understanding the difference between disruption versus psychotic episode or psychosis is something I learned actually in the mental health book. It's crazy because I felt like even kids could learn this. The difference between aggressive, assertive, and passive. As you deal with an individual on a case-by-case basis, you will have to be able to be comfortable in all three of those roles. You'll have to be able to be assertive to a point. But then there are certain times if you're dealing with somebody who's really, really belligerent or really, really under the influence that your intention is to hurt them, then you need to be passive. And you need to learn when to use these specific things. And I think those things are, I congratulate the library for that. I think that's something that needs to be taught.
So a customer comes to mind, and Ryan, I know you're you've met her and everything. She's hung out on the first floor a couple of times. I initially met her on the eighth floor. I got called up because this customer was making some disturbance. She was sort of spazzing out involuntarily. She was saying things erratically and being very loud. And then in addition to that, she was shaking uncontrollably and she was throwing things from her purse. And so the staff on the eighth floor really didn't know exactly how to deal with the situation. And so I go upstairs, you know, introduce myself, ask her name. All of a sudden, she gets out of, you know, the mode that she was in, and we just start having a conversation. Within that period of time, she had a few awkward, you know, things that happened, but nothing too extreme. We carried on the conversation for about 30 minutes. But what I learned from that was that she's been seen by medical professionals, she's been seen by psychiatric professionals, and no one has been able to give her a specific diagnosis for this bout that she has. But when people talk to her, it sort of takes the attention from her off of what she's doing, and it distracts her, and it's a healthy distraction, and she sort of calms down. But naturally, over time, after 5 or 10 minutes of doing this, she'll calm down, like even on her own. Being able to communicate that to staff who may have been afraid to even talk to her or deal with this issue was really helpful, because now all of a sudden they feel empowered to say, hey, you know, what's going on? Is there anything that I can do for you? And then, you know, take the situation in their own hands.
Did you use her name a lot?
I did. And every time I see her, I always call her by her name. And to be absolutely sure that I do that.
That's one of the key things when people are in psychosis or have severe schizophrenia, is to use their name. And usually a lot of things don't work, but the name usually brings them out of it, and they actually can focus on that because it's theirs. So that's a really important tool to have, is, you know, you introduce yourself and say, I'm Joe Smith and your name is, well, Susie, nice to meet you. You know, what can we do to help you, and make them feel safe and secure, like it sounds like you did.
Since you've been here, Miss Janice, I wanted to ask, have you dealt with any situations wherein you had to assess it as far as being a mental illness issue, or maybe just a situation where you dealt with individuals who were struggling for mental illness?
Well, surely there are times. I mean, it's not really our role to assess. There are occasions when we deal with people who have issues, and there was a time a couple of weeks ago I'm thinking of where we got a call from the third floor, and there was a lady up there that was being disruptive. And as you were talking, Malcolm, I realized that just sort of naturally, I think compassion is the key. And I think if you kind of approach it with compassion, we did actually, you know, introduce ourselves and got her name and started calling her by her name. And we said, Miss, now I can't remember her name, but Miss Susie, why don't you come down with us to the first floor and we can help you out there. So it was that kind of situation. And she was fine with that.
One of the key things that we tell people, law enforcement or whoever, is that you need to visualize that this person is your family member. And how would you like your family member treated?
With respect and dignity. So I'm grateful to have everybody here on the show. Y'all stay tuned then. We'll be right back. So we're back on the show with Mr. John Dornheim, Mr. Malcolm Varnum, Ms. Janice Brunswert, and Mr. Ryan Smith. Sorry. I'm used to calling you the captain. It's cool. And we wanted to just like kind of just take this time out to make sure individuals are informed on how they can contribute, because this is an informative session. Yes, it is. But I like them to be persuasive. I like to persuade individuals to actually do the very thing that is our drive here at the library, which is to empower individuals to take the initiative to move, not just listen to, because I can listen to self-help, but then I could actually apply the principles. So I'm going to ask you, Mr. Dornheim, how does an individual get involved?
Well, actually, we've had a lot of people just wander in or call lately who want to get involved. And that's been great, because we need all the volunteers we can get. So actually, in the last 2 weeks, we probably had 5 or 6 people set up appointments and come in and try to figure out where they fit in with trying to help NAMI. So people can go again, to the website, namidallas.org. They can call at 214-341-7133 and say, I'd love to volunteer. They can get involved with our walk. And that's, they can go on the website and click on how to get involved in the walk. They can form a walk team. They can become a walker. They can become a sponsor or get their company to sponsor. It's really easy. The whole premise behind the walk is that you get 100 people, and those 100 people each get 10 people to give them $10, and you raise $100,000.
I have a question. You mentioned companies. Who's all under the umbrella of NAMI here in Dallas?
Well, we have no one under our umbrella, but if you're talking about like who we would refer to or partner with, we consider, you know, of course, the City of Dallas, Senior Services and the Police Department and LifeNet and MetroCare and a ton of Mental Health America. We do a lot of work with Mental Health America, especially when it comes to advocacy. We work closely together with them on that. We work with basically all the counseling centers and the schools like SMU and UNT and TWU. We actually have a NAMI on campus there that's growing, and one of the students there is one of our volunteers now. And so there's actually going to be a concert in a couple months that's going to be a mental illness concert from 6 to 9. I can't remember the date now. It's in April, though. So I think it's April 9th. So I think it's exciting that the kids in college are getting involved in this because, as we talked about before, you know, so many of people have their first issue with mental illness when they're in college age.
We did talk about that. And we also talked about stigmas. And so, you know, it'd be not cool or not hip to say that I have a mental illness. So how do you deal with that? Anybody, like, how do you deal with that? A stigma. We talked about the word stigma. You were saying, yo, man, there's a group of individuals who say, don't even say stigma, because you think something that's associated with that. So, I mean, how would you deal with
it? You know, there used to be a stigma with being gay. I mean, there still is in some respect, but, you know, I think talking about it, not hiding it in the closet. There's a closet for a lot of things, and mental illness has been behind a closet for a long time, and it peeks out a little bit. So that's one of the things that we need to have people who, you know, we have some celebrities now who are coming out about their mental illnesses or their family's mental illnesses. Glenn Close has been really wonderful about her sister and her sister's mental illness. And, you know, some other celebrities have done a little bit, but Glenn Close has really been the preeminent one who's come out and said, you know what, I have mental illness in my family, and so what?
And in terms of the group, you know, that's talking about let's not use the term, I think it's sort of self-defeating, you know, like you talked about sort of, you know, it used to be taboo or a stigma, you know, to be gay or whatnot. But the LGBT community has certainly taken up the term queer, for an example, as a way to sort of empower themselves and say, this is who we are, and just put it out there and identify the elephant in the room as opposed to ignoring it, you know, and not pretending it's there. And so in the same way with stigma and mental illness, I think certainly, you know, talking about it, and there's a book by, it's called Black Pain, and it's by Terry Williams, and she's one of I'm one of her biggest fans. But she talks about mental illness in the Black community and how we need to sort of name it and claim it and accept that talking, you know, can be a form of healing. It could be cathartic. And so if we don't talk about it, then it binds us, and there's no way we can heal if we don't expose, you know, those sores. And so talking about it is important.
You know, and one of the big things is to talk about mental health more than mental illness, because you want to have good mental health. If you use that terminology, it's a lot less scary for a lot of people. And, you know, good mental health means making sure that you are sleeping well and that you're eating well and that you're exercising and that you don't have too much stress on yourself. And that if you feel like you do, then you go to your company and say, I need to go see a therapist, or I need to, you know, I get a checkup a little bit because I'm not quite sure on myself. So, you know, part of it is using kind of the positive language of health. And when you go into a company, you say, let's have a mental health checkup and let's talk to your staff about what good mental health looks like.
And often those two terms are used interchangeably when there's an important difference to recognize there.
But I do think the positive thing is the language, just as you said. Again, I had never actually heard the word assertive until, or actually I might have heard it, but not actually understood it until I read that. Read the information that I got and that I received. And once I got it, I immediately felt like, okay, me as an individual have always been on extremes. It's either I'm trying to be all the way good, or I'm trying to be all the way bad. But to be assertive is to live comfortably. It's to say you and I are having a conflict. It's to say that your point of view is very valid, but it's not more important than my point of view. And as an individual, when you find yourselves in different situations, systems, you have to be able to speak your mind from your own valued point of view whilst also assessing another individual's. That's kind of, it's necessary in anything you do. In any communication system, you're going to need that. And this is why I felt that it was necessary to teach. And I think it's perfect mental health, as in a sense. It's mental health. It's a necessary quality we need, especially somebody who's like myself, who thinks in stigmas and thinks in categories and thinks in, I guess you would say, in rational ways that also integrate parts of stereotypes. Because my logic can be one thing. My logic can be based upon what I see, but also if I've always been taught that this stereotype is the right way in which I should go, okay, all black people are this, so my rationale is based upon the stigma that's put there. And so it's better to get the language out there so we could understand each other better. If I'm coming from an emotional standpoint of view, I'd like to be able or equipped or empowered to utilize words that will direct my point of view without actually having to say, I feel upset and angry, and so now I'm going to act that out physically. Does that make sense?
And I think that's what you said is one of the reasons why I love NAMI so much, is because NAMI is totally non-discriminatory against anything, because the whole premise behind mental illness and good mental health is that you can't discriminate against anybody, because everybody will discriminate against somebody with mental illness. There is a whole center set up for black relations, Hispanic, Asian, GLBT, Y, M-A-N-S, the whole gamut. And there's even a transgender group now with NAMI National. And so they're very much on the forefront of everybody being treated equally and really trying to push to get into communities that don't understand mental health and mental illness, the black community, the Hispanic community, and finding out that, you know, you have to go through the church, or you have to go through the matriarch, or you have to, you know, how you get into those communities and how you help them so that their mental health is better than it is now, because we know that the communities that are not being reached have a lower level of positive mental health.
Well, this was informative and persuasive in a lot of senses. I challenge individuals to get their language, a set of language that will promote mental health rather than promote mental illness, or have somebody feeling they feel outsided or segregated because they have a mental illness. I'd like to have productive mental health. I think this is for everybody. John Dornheim, thank you for coming on the show today. I'm definitely appreciative of you and NAMI and the whole effort and the continual effort that you guys are putting forward to promoting mental health. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Mr. Malcolm, I see you later. Nah, Mr. Malcolm, thanks. Mr. Malcolm Varner, I appreciate you coming out. Ms. Janice, our new AmeriCorps member, alongside Ms. Amabel, you guys are doing an excellent job. I really, really appreciate it. Can't do it without you, Mr. DeCabin. We can't do it without you, man. I appreciate you coming out, man, and putting us together, man, doing this for us. If y'all guys don't mind, I'd like to pray us out of here, man. Father God, thank you for coming together with us, having us to be here as a collective unit, talking about something that really deals with community and deals with communion between all individuals, God. We ask that the love and the peace and the joy will flow from us so that we might be able to share that. We're grateful for all that you have given us. But we also want to be able to do the things that you would have us to do, which is love our fellow man and woman. So we grateful and we thank you. And we pray this prayer with sincerity in our hearts. And we go with the initiative to love in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Street View. You can visit us online at streetviewpodcast.com. Tune us in again next time for more discussion.